Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
My guest today has a wealth of experience in production and communication, having juggled both extremely successfully throughout her career. Her motorsport journey started in the heart of it all, working for Formula One Management. Over 16 years, she went from strength to strength within the company, working behind the scenes at first, and then very much in the thick of it as floor manager during live broadcasts. She's been instrumental, my words not hers, she's way too humble, in many of the key moments you've witnessed in F1's recent years. From Arnold Schwarzenegger's podium interviews to capturing Lewis Hamilton's first moment as a first-time F1 world champion. A short freelance stint saw her take on the PR for the Mexican Grand Prix as part of the Ncrush team, a race which is well known to be one of the most fun rounds each year. Before moving teamside for the first time, joining Racing Point, now Aston Martin F1 team, for four seasons. My guest today is my lovely friend, Joanne Revel.
In fact, I want to check one thing straight away, is how do you actually say your last name? Because I say it like a French person, or like a French person trying to speak English.
It's Revel, just like the sweets, with the coffee ones that not everybody likes. But yeah, it's just Revel, just spelled differently.
I love it. That's a good way to remember. I'll kick off then. I'll start with my absolute favourite questions, which is, now tell me, Joanne, when and where did your racing life begin?
Well, it's quite a few years ago now. I actually started in archives and records management. I, like so many other people, didn't really know what to do at school. So I did history, which I loved. And I didn't want to teach, so I moved, you know, I wanted to do something practical with history, carry on studying history, if you like. So I fell into archives and records management, so looking after historical documents. And I worked at Liverpool University looking, cataloguing the papers of John Wyndham, who is the author of the science fiction books. Most famous probably is David Triffitt's. And while I was there, I kind of didn't feel I was quite in the right job. I didn't really come from a family of petrol heads, really. But I loved, I had fallen in love with Formula One in my late teens, I would say. I went on a German exchange trip and there was a girl there who was a big fan of Ayrton Senna. And through her, I started to follow the sport. Before then, it had been something that was something, you know, it was on a Sunday afternoon after your Sunday roast kind of thing, but we didn't really watch it as a family. Nobody in my family is really into cars, and my family were all teachers, really. So I developed this love of motorsport and Formula One. And when I was at Liverpool working, actually, that's not right. So let me say that again. So when I was actually working in archives, I came across another young lady who was also into F1. Notice all three of these people who've brought me into F1 have been ladies. I hadn't really thought about that before, but Claire was a good friend of mine, and we used to stay up at all hours watching Malaysian Grand Prix, Japanese Grand Prix, and our poor friend Jen would stay over and wonder why we'd be up at 4 o'clock in the morning to do this. But kind of there was a bit of a community sort of feel, you know, we loved it. It was something we did. And while I was at Liverpool, I decided I'd give myself 6 months to try and get into Formula One somehow. And this obviously predated you know, jobs being advertised online and, you know, the internet, social media, all of those things. So you kind of didn't have really much of a window into the sport, and not going to local motorsport meets or even going to races, you didn't meet people necessarily. So it's hard to make contact. So autosport was the window into the world of motorsport and F1. And I was in a supermarket and I was being a bit naughty and picked up autosport, had a quick flick through to look at the jobs. And there it was. There was a job for a junior scriptwriter. And there was no indication. I've got the advert here in front of me. And there's nothing to say what company it was. This is all it says. Must have extensive knowledge in motorsport. A journalistic background may be an advantage. All applicants must be systematic, ambitious, and well organised. That's it. So it turned out that job was for Bernie Eccleston at Formula One Management. And I think that was advertised in the March of 2001. I had an interview sometime June, July, which is actually the same weekend as the Biggin Hill Air Show. So it was really hard to actually have an interview with the people who were interviewing, who were both softly spoken and planes flying overhead. And you kept saying, pardon, pardon what? Sorry, no, can you just repeat the question? And then must think I just a death or something. So I somehow survived the interview. And then even a little bit more paperwork. You can tell I was an archivist. I have the...
This is the
offer letter.
Oh my gosh, this is offer letter. Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Oh my goodness. So that was starting in the August of that year. And that's basically how I started, really. So a slightly unconventional way in. But I took that job. I figured at the time my worst case scenario was that if it doesn't work out, that I go back home. I live with my parents in Wrexham and I start again. And that was in 2001. And here we are now.
That's absolutely brilliant. The bit that I took away the most, though, is that for some reason you became a fan of Formula One, but didn't decide to stay a fan of Formula One. You identified it as a place where you wanted to work. And I'm always interested in that because I did the same thing. In fact, I was never a fan of Formula One. I identified it as a place to work straight away. That was literally my way into F1, wasn't enjoying it as a fan. It was putting up with it and then working out that actually it was the best place ever to work and then setting on the journey to do it. So I'm just always fascinated by what might have been the switch going from enjoying it with your friends, which, as you said, were ladies, which is lovely to hear. And then actually made you think, no, I want to work there. I want to get in there. I want to break that.
I think it was just, I've always wanted to do something different. And sadly, I was never a rock star. So that didn't quite work.
You'd be so good as a rock star.
I played saxophone in school. But yeah, that rock star career never quite happened. But yeah, I think I've always wanted to do something a bit different. My whole family were teachers. Dad, a head teacher. So, you know, a long line of teachers and, you know, also... when you're growing up with a surname like Revel, it's not local to where I'm from. So you'd go to anything school related. Who's Mr. Revel's daughter? It's like, And even like I did summer jobs, and as most people do when you're students, and Wrexham has a large food manufacturing industry. And so I ended up one time in a meat factory, beef factory, and it was in a place called Llai, which was where my mum and dad settled when they first moved there. And my dad taught in the school however many years prior to that. And we were in the washroom and you had to wear like a helmet, hairnet, white coat, wellies and everything and spray everything down. And it wasn't the best part of the day. And someone came in, the lady in charge of the line came in and said, "Who's Mr. Revel's daughter?" And I was like, oh... do I A, put my hand up and say yes, or B, say no? And I was like, okay, yeah, it's me. It got me moved on to a different line, a better line. So I think I learned pretty quickly that, you know, having contacts and being well respected and having those around you who are well respected is helpful and can move you on places.
Yeah, and that's a big lesson to learn before Formula One, actually, because the whole of motorsport's a massive network, isn't it?
I think as well, when you know, I just went to a comprehensive and it's probably something more drilled into people who are in maybe private schools, the benefit of making contacts, of where, you know, meeting influential people who end up in influential places. You don't quite learn that when you're, you know, you're studying in a comprehensive, or you certainly didn't at my school. So it was not something I've had to learn along the way and realise pretty quickly that that was the way forward. So
can we point out Wrexham? Current news, as far as I'm concerned, is Wrexham Football Club. Really? That is the same place that we get to watch on Netflix with two very, very well-known Hollywood celebrities.
Exactly,
now
yes.
Running it.
That is where I'm from. You know, I really love seeing what's happening at Wrexham now. It's even now a city. It was made a city last year. But what they're doing with the football club, you know, I think, you know, on a personal level, for what it's done for my hometown, the hope, the buoyancy, the interest, you know, the fact that people in America are buying Wrexham football shirts is crazy. You know, the sales have been really quite strong, and a lot of t-shirts being sold in America, which is like, I think they said something like 21,000 or something last year. Well, you wouldn't have sold that in Wrexham previously. So, you know, I love what they're doing. It's also really authentic. You know, they're staying true to the fans. They're staying true to the people who are part of that club, part of that town. And that's what so many big brands often get wrong. You know, football club is location-based. You're less likely to be a Wrexham fan if you don't have any connection to the area. However, they're managing to kind of blow that out the water by great marketing campaigns. And even how they announced or started to drip feed the news that they were going to take over, both Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. There was a tweet from, I'm going to say 2011 or 12, and a Wrexham lady had said something along the lines of, you know, wouldn't it be great if Ryan Reynolds was in Wrexham or something like that? And he retweeted it 8 years later saying, wouldn't it just, I've waited 8 years to write this tweet kind of thing. It's just like this crazy kind of storm of everybody getting involved, and there being a sense of, you know, history, because it is the third oldest club in the country. And, you know, there is that history of being the underdog, of being, you know, of fighting. It's just a really great thing to see, I think. You know, what they've done is just incredible. And like I say, it's the authenticity. I think that they're not trying to sell it as something different. It's about the people. It's about keeping it real. And that's just such a great thing.
It's as a complete outsider with very little interest in football other than the World Cup every few years, I've absolutely loved following the journey. I love the series. It's been so much fun discovering that side of football, actually. I'm now going sometimes to my local Oxford football club, which I never thought I'd do in my life. So yeah, it's really
good to see. And you know, when you see, I see a lot of similarities with what's going on at Wrexham to where I have been previously, in the growing of the club from a much smaller club with great ambitions. They're currently top of the league. I don't know when, hopefully we still will be by the time this is aired. But we're not top of the league, but top of, you know, we're trying to get back into the league. So we're top of our table, yeah, if you like. So we had the unenviable, events that happened with the financial situation of the club meant that we lost 10 points. And after losing 10 points, we then got relegated and have been out of the Football League ever since. So that's quite an unenviable sort of title to have. So now, hopefully they can push on through and rejoin the league.
I hope so. But this podcast is about motorsport, and this is the most I've ever spoken about football on there. So let's go back to motorsport. No. I asked the question. I would love to know, do you have an earliest memory of motorsport or Formula One, and what is it?
Ooh, that would be around the time I would have been sixth form college and doing that German exchange trip. I don't really have much recollection beforehand. You know, we weren't a family of Formula One or motorsport nuts. My parents, actually, as well as both being teachers, are both very musical, like into music, live concerts. So that was more of a family thing rather than sports generally, I would say. So I don't even remember the first race I watched, I'm sad to say, but it was certainly around that time, you know, which it would have been in Senna's later years, I would say.
There was very much that girl that you met, her passion for Formula One that got you in, rather than anything that you ended up witnessing as in the very start of it.
Yeah, I would say so. I suppose really a common interest, sharing a common interest more than anything. Mm. And then I started to follow it a bit more myself, started to watch Formula One on TV, and then that carried on into my, you know, late teens, early 20s, and then into this job.
These jobs, yeah. And to summarise your career in way, way too little words, over 16 years working for Formula One management, which is absolutely incredible. And actually, it's very credible because so many people stayed for a very long time because it was such a cool place to work. But it's still completely amazing. And followed by a little bit of freelancing, and then followed by Aston Martin. And of course, because I've known you so well for the last few years, the bit I'm most fascinated about is your career at Formula One Management, because you started as an archivist. But when I meet you 10 years later, you're definitely not an archivist. Sorry, storyteller, a copywriter. You're very much on the ground making things happen. So for the purpose of everybody else listening, would you be kind enough to describe what your role was like in the evolution?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think I've been very lucky. So I started out as that junior scriptwriter, which was scriptwriter slash researcher, I would say. So my first year, second part of the season, was spent in a hangar in Biggin Hill. There were several buildings, if you like, connected. There was Sapphire House, Diamond House, and one other. This name escapes me at the moment. I was based at Diamond House, and as I say, I was in a hangar, but I was in like an airplane container in the hangar. And that was converted into an edit suite. And basically, I sat there in the dark with the editor at the time, and I'd be going through all the footage. And it was on tapes back in those days. So the cameraman's footage, the cameraman you'd see in the pit lane, you'd see those cameramen in the pit lane. They'd be capturing footage all the time, the live cameramen, the post-production cameramen, the track cameramen. So there'd be different feeds. You'd have the sort of track A, I think, at the time. That was the following the cars at the front of the field. Track B, any other battles. That could be midfield, could be at the back, but, you know, the key battles, onboard feeds. So you'd be logging all of those things in a manual way, writing down anything that happened, any kind of key things of interest. So yes, they'd be based in this hangar, and it was great because it really taught you everything that was available in the archive, everything that was being captured. And I wasn't going to races at that time. You know, this hangar was also quite a bizarre place to work because it was where Bernie kept his Brabham F1 cars. So you go in from the main building, wow, and on the right there were all the Brabham cars stacked on like shelves, for want of a better word. And then it was a hangar, so the doors would open and you had this panoramic view to central London. So it was all very surreal for me, starting out in my time at Formula One, kind of going from a very different world, from a home in Wrexham, from working in Liverpool in the archives, to this kind of thing. So I was still, although I was working in basements in archives, I was still in a dark room watching footage. But it was great. You know, you really learnt the ropes. You were looking for, you know, you'd be logging standard shots, if you like, car going in and out of the garage. They'd be used for sort of highlights packages or for the end of year review, well, video as it was back in those days, DVD. And any kind of bloopers for the FIA gala at the end of the year. So back in those days, you'd have Bernie's trophies, so winning nationality driver, which at the time, Schumacher, so generally German drivers, broadcaster, and I think circuit. So you'd be always looking for those kind of shots. So I don't know, Martin Brundle, if he made a mistake, or, you know, you clip it up kind of thing. Kai Abel from RTL clipped that up. So you had all these at the end of the year for the typical kind of edits you're used to seeing of comedy music, that kind of thing. So it was quite a varied start, and that carried on for a couple of years. And I moved more to being a post-production assistant. Now, at the time, F1 Digital existed, and that was pay-per-view television, but really the world wasn't ready for it. And unfortunately, I think, was it 2003? I mean, I can check my... I'm going to show you another. This is these newspaper cuttings from the time.
Oh, wow.
So let's see if we can see a date on these for you. 2002. So at the end of 2002, I'd been there just over a year. We were told that the F1 Digital was unfortunately not going to continue, and therefore jobs would unfortunately be lost. Now, I was in a slightly different position. I worked in post-production. Many live production roles just didn't exist. But I was in post-production, and I actually was one of few people that had, there were two of us doing the same job, two script writers. So I was up against my colleague and basically had to sort of almost fight to keep my job. So I was on gardening leave at the start of the 2003 season, as many people were, while the decisions were made. And then I spent that time, I guess, fighting for my role, because it was a fight in the sense that there were two of us, whereas some people it was a simple, no, your job no longer exists. I wanted my job and I wanted to stay. So I continued to write things like detailed race reports for the editors who were still working. And I convinced my then boss, Steve Smith, who still is in F1, you may have met him, heading up the onboard camera team, and he kept me. So I had another season of researching and script writing for the end of year DVD. And then I think 2003 or 2004, there became an opportunity to go trackside and to basically be a post-production assistant, a VT op. So I was working with the engineers to record the different feeds. So whereas in Biggin Hill, I had been logging them, watching them back over, watching every race, you know, however many times through different camera views, if you like. Now I was going to races and I was making sure these got recorded. And, you know, it's a manual process. You really need to remember to press record for that tape not to have a technical problem, if you like. So, you know, it's not quite so easy to try. You know, nowadays, if things are recorded on drives and what have you, there's an opportunity to maybe salvage them when things go wrong. But the tape is a tape, and they can get tangled and things like that. They can get left at airports as well. That can happen. I got asked to go to a few races. I think I was told I'd be going to about six races, and I think I missed three in the 2004 season. And, you know, at that time I was so, you know, I was young. I'd not travelled. I was going to Australia, and Jonathan, my boss at the time, said, "Oh, well, we're going to film at the we're going to the 12 Apostles, and we're going to go at the Great Ocean Road. Do you want to come? You're going to have to leave at like 3 a.m. And I'm just like, "Yes, of course, I'm gonna go." So off we went with Jean-Michel Tibby, and I think enough years have passed for me to be able to say, because health and safety rules would have changed in this time. But I remember going, having to hold on. One of my first jobs was to hold on the back of Jean-Michel by his belt of his trousers as he was filming out the back of the car to film the journey along the Great Ocean Road. So, you know, those kind of experiences just took them as you would, you know, and it was a little bit of a surreal world, you know. Like I say, I did most of the races that year. And then after that, I pretty much did all races. And the role kind of evolved over time in that, you know, more I got given more tasks. I used to do the interviews for the Porsche Super Cup program. So Formula One, I think, still do create a highlights program for Porsche. So you it was a good place for me to sort of learn the basics of putting a program together from being on site and then working with the editor back in Biggin Hill. But I also used to do the interviews. So it was a good way to start out interviewing people. I mean, Porsche drivers are far more friendly than many of the other people I've interviewed in my time. Exactly.
Got all time.
And you see, you know, you see them weekly, and you know, that tends to be the drivers are doing well, and so they get to know you and those kind of things. So that was a great place for me to sort of start out on that side of things. And I didn't realize at the time when I left Formula One many years later, I had a habit when I would do these Porsche interviews of saying, so here we are in Spain, so here we are in Monaco. And the editor, the long-term editor of the Porsche programs, Dave Beach, thought it'd be hilarious to comp these up. So basically the compilation of me going, so here we are in Spain, so here we are here. I'm just like, thanks, guys. I'm glad I provided.
Nice leaving present. For you, so. What was it like going from watching the races, watching the footage, as you said, many times over, so the same race several times from all the different camera in that dark room, to suddenly being right in the thick of it, literally in the paddock, all of a sudden you're there and it's not through a lens anymore, you're
well,
completely
I was still
there.
In a dark room, because I was in the then I think I'm not sure what it's called nowadays, but the broadcast center was also dark.
Broadcast center, yeah.
Still in a dark room, but it was just a wow experience. You know, you're sat there, it's stressful as well, because you're, you know, one of the jobs I used to do was to, you'd need to get the pole position lap recorded to the onboard camera pole position lap recorded to a tape to give to the broadcasters. So for the likes of ITV, as it was, for Martin Brundle to talk over on the pre-race programme. So you'd have to do that really quickly. But again, it's a manual process. You'd have the onboard cameras in front of you and you'd be literally watching. The systems were different back in those days, so they'd be quite, you might get breakup and what have you, so you'd be kind of looking for quality, you'd be quality checking, trying to make sure you got the time code of when the driver started a fast lap, did he finish, was it a fast lap, watch the timing pages, and then afterwards go back to, right, okay, so these are your, you know, Kimi, Fernando, Michael, whatever, keep, know roughly where they are on the tapes, and then kind of right quick, record it as quickly as you can to give to the broadcasters who come knocking shortly after, half an hour after qualifying finish, going, right, we need our tape because we need to start work on it. Yeah.
Need to do the show.
So, you know, wow. You just had to be quick. You had to be, but it was fun, you know, as well. You know, there's, if there was a problem, you had to solve that as quickly as you could. You just had to think on your feet, you know. We also, I mean, back in those days, do you remember the old F1 logo when the music? I used to have to put that on a tape and give it to the host broadcast. So this was before F1, you know, was the host broadcaster for every race. It would be a national broadcaster. So you'd give a copy of the logo to the German broadcaster. And I remember giving the master tape one time to Frank from Speed Channel America. And I was mortified. I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to get sacked. And it's just a tape. I just had to ask for it back. But I was still in my new junior days. And Frank came, he realised what had happened, came back on the golf buggy and brought the tape back. And I think you gave me the wrong one. I was like, oh, goodness, please don't tell Jonathan I'm going to get in trouble. I don't think I would, but, you know, you're young, you're new.
No, but you know, will.
It's a different time. So it was a really good way for me to get a good grounding. And also I got to know the broadcasters, the people, my equivalents at those different networks, and it was a great grounding, I would say.
What did it feel like going to digital? Because obviously so much of what you're describing, I've only really encountered the digital version just because I was doing something else at that time. I wasn't on that side of things. I'm discovering the production and the broadcasting aspect of it very much more now, or the last few years. Was it gentle? Was it like a sort of gentle shift, or was it literally from one day to the next? Okay, right, we're replacing all the equipment. We're going
Formula
digital.
One was always, as a company now, FOM, was always very technologically ahead of itself, I would suppose you would say, just the fact that they had the travelling broadcast centre. Now, obviously, things are changing and they're able to do more, you know, technology is evolving again. And through COVID, they learnt what could be done remotely, which obviously has benefits for people travelling, for sustainability, which are all, you know, very positive things. So it's something the company's always dealt well with, I think. You know, the exception probably was that the pay-per-view was ahead of its game. People weren't ready to pay. You know, we're quite used to now taking a subscription to watch a certain program on a certain channel that you don't necessarily subscribe to all the time. So it's a different mindset now, whereas back then it was probably just ahead of the game. And the way they built the broadcast center to travel, you know, all of those things. So there's some great people there who have, you know, great technical knowledge that I don't have and just come up with these ideas. So, you know, it was something. I worked in post-production. I actually had a dual role in my later time at F1. So I worked in post-production, but I, at races, had a live production role. So, you know, day-to-day in post-production, I'd work on things like the end-of-year DVD. I used to write the script for that and work closely with Ben Edwards. You know, Ben would be a complete saviour when you get to the end of the year. And he's such a great person to work with. You'd be writing a script on a plane back from Abu Dhabi and you'd look at it and go, I'd often say to Ben, I've just got no more words left to say. Like, and he'd come in fresh and, you know, ready and just help you out kind of thing. And yes, that's it. That's so simple, you know, but he'd always have that kind of way of, I guess, bolstering you and reminding you, you know, you've just got off a plane. Don't worry about it. I've got some thoughts. Let's work through this together. But then I had a live role that was floor managing, essentially. So I'd be in the pit lane. And I'd be like the eyes and ears for the cameramen and for the production team in the gallery. So I guess you might say I was like a little spy in the paddock and pit lane.
Yeah.
But you'd be looking for developing stories or if, you know, something was happening in the garage and, you know, to get a camera there. You'd be there to liaise with people on the pit wall, perhaps if there was a problem with the radio or something like that. So you're always kind of looking for a news story, if you like. And it could be, it was, as much as you're not racing yourself, you're not competing, there's still a real buzz, there's still a real thrill because, you know, I think back to when Lewis won his first title in, I'm going to say 2008, Brazil. And, you know, as a broadcaster, you want those emotional shots. And I remember being with the cameraman. Lewis was in the McLaren hospitality room, I think in his driver room, actually, with his dad. And kind of like overwhelmed with emotion, kind of, you know, head in hands in a good way. And I just remember sort of pushing the cameraman. That sounds a bit off, but, you know, just go film. I'll deal with it later.
Encouraging strongly.
I'll deal with it later kind of thing, you know. But knowing you've got that shot, that you've captured that real emotion, you know, was always something quite, you got a buzz from. You know, sort of seeing, being in the right place, or when Jensen won his first title and his dad and his friends chose to hide away from the cameras, but they knew us because we'd also, I was friends with Nicola Armstrong, who was at Honda and then Braun. And when they were Honda and weren't doing so well, I'd go there for a coffee because I wasn't really allowed to do that back in those days. It was frowned upon. But you wouldn't see anybody there because they weren't doing very well. I got along with Nicola and you were safe from prying eyes, as it were. So when it all turned around in 2009 for them, they were very happy to see us because we'd kind of been there in the bad times and we were there in the good times.
Yeah.
But it meant that we were in the tyres because John Button was sort of in the tyre area right at the end of the paddock in Brazil. hidden away from everybody, and they let us stay there to get those shots with them as he crossed the line and took his championship. Wow. So.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's so much of it when you started that role, the sort of floor managing and let's get an official spy.
No.
It's not spying really, because it's a two-way street. You know, I used to text you. I used to send you a message if I had anybody of note in the garage or if anything was happening. To encourage a camera to calm down, because at the end of the day, we also, especially if we weren't at the top, we were trying to get the coverage, and also because it was exciting. I think sometimes we had celebrities, like I remember one year Dua Lipa came in. That was really cool. We're like, you know, come and see Dua Lipa in our garage. Yeah. This is amazing. And also when, obviously, you know, when something was going wrong, more often than not, we'd be getting text messages or WhatsApps or whatever from broadcasters, from journalists, and from yourselves as well. And we'd just, you know, say, you know, we're not going out for whatever reason, or this has happened, we're working on it, or, you know, we're finding out. So it's always been a two-way street. But then I'm sure there was instances where we might be a bit more coy or might be not sharing information just yet. And you couldn't wait that long. You had to do that. But I know both yourselves and your lovely colleague Amy were the two that I always worked with, and I would often tell you stuff that shouldn't be public knowledge just yet, but I knew I could trust you with that information. And I think that's a massive testament to the relationship building. As you said, you know, you were always there, you're always a constant, you're always fair, and obviously always friendly. And that always went such a long way, because as I often say, we might all be competing on track and we might all be trying to control our narrative as much as possible, but it's still one big family and we are still putting on a show together. So it's fascinating hearing you speak about it, what it was like, you know, just you were there when John Button saw his son become world champion. That's huge. That's just, that makes me tingle.
I've been in some very privileged positions, and as you say, it's about having those relationships with the team to know when it's appropriate to do what you're doing as well. You know, if that had been Lewis not winning the title, I wouldn't have done that, but he'd won the title.
Yeah.
It was all good, it's good to see, kind of thing. You know, get a few shots and come out.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Get the shots and leave them, kind of thing. So, and you knew what not to show on a car, you know, what to try and avoid. That
yes.
was, you know, yes, you'd show that there's activity perhaps going on in a car, but you don't need to show inner workings of the car for people. That's not what you're trying to do. You're trying to show that there's a drama. And then, you know, I've had that in my own time working in a Formula One team. I've seen when things go wrong. And I actually, I think, was it 2019, I actually saw three different parts of my F1 career kind of came together in Mexico, because I'd obviously worked at Formula One. I had a year of freelancing and I'd worked for the Mexican Grand Prix. And I was at Racing Point and Checo was one of our drivers. And Fermín Lecalaca, the Day of the Dead guy, as many people know him. I'd obviously got to know him when I was working for the Mexican Grand Prix. And then we managed to, you know, you're always thinking that when you go the other side, when your team side, you know, thinking of things that you can tell the cameraman that get you on camera. Because as you say, if your car isn't doing so well, it can be difficult to get the coverage you might want. So you have to be a bit creative. So I managed to message one of my old colleagues at F1 to say, Fermín has come in our garage and he was going to greet Checo in the car, basically, ahead of Friday practice, I think it was. So I therefore had, you know, an F1 camera. Well, I had a couple of F1 cameramen. I used to find these days, once I went team side, they listened to me more than when I actually worked at F1 because they usually had something for them to film if I came waving or looking for them in the pit lane. Fermín was there and Checo was there and waving on camera. And we also had him in the garage during the race. He sat with the mechanics as watching the race. So it was kind of, it was really nice to see those three worlds all coming together in one to give us some coverage. I can't remember what the race result was. I don't think we did particularly well, but, you know, it was great to have that courage and the coverage and that feel good vibe and celebrating. Yeah, and celebrating moment. Mexico, yeah. You know, the Mexican driver, that's very important to the Mexican Grand Prix. So it was great to actually see those worlds come together. But, you know, you have been in that privileged position. I used to put the microphones, we used to call them the Kylie mics, on the drivers and the Unilats. Unilaterals, so that when the top three would sit there and talk about the race, and I put the microphone on, you know, people who just won the championship, and you know, it's kind of,
yeah,
it's a very privileged position to be in, to be part of that moment with them, and to be, you know, they're emotionally shocked, overwhelmed, happy, you know, and also you can be there with the person who doesn't. Yeah, exactly. So lost, you have to be mindful of that, diplomatic. You can't get overwhelmed. You can't, you know, you're there to do your job. You're not there to be their friend or what have you. So, but, you know, it's, I'm lucky to have been in that position, but it doesn't always go right. I do. One of the replays guys took a screenshot of me in Singapore some years ago. I put the microphone on and they're like a question mark over the ear. And
yeah,
Kimi had a new hat and for whatever reason it got stuck. And the more I tried to remove it, the more stuck it got. And I have a really funny photo of me behind Kimi, like pulling this face, like, oh, this is all going terribly wrong. I don't know what to do. And Kimi's just smiling in a kind of Alan Partridge-esque kind of, ah, and sort of just thinking, oh, somehow managed to get it sorted. But yeah, it doesn't always, live TV doesn't always go right, I guess, does it? So.
I mean, the fact that Kimi was smiling, that's a win in itself anyway.
I always got on well with Kimi, I think, because I didn't do small talk with him. I know he didn't like small talk and I didn't really feel the need to do that either. But I was always quite straight with him. And I remember one year he finished third in the championship. He was going to the FIA Awards in Turkey that year. And we used to do the filming. We'd make a special package, if you like, for the event. And there would always be some element of bespoke filming with the top three drivers. It might be. There was one year it was kind of casino themed. One year with Fernando, it was a flamenco dancer, sorry, not driver. Lots of different things like this. Battersea Power Station with Jensen when he won. anyway, this year I was picking up Kimmy, and he'd needed to finish. I think Andy, who'd been at Lotus before you, had said, oh, Kimmy needs to leave. Can we go early? I was like, yeah, no problem. We'll move it forward. I went to pick him up and he's like, oh, so what is this then? And I said to him, said to Kimmy, well, the thing is, this is the last thing on your day and you want to go. I said, you're the last driver on my day and I want to go. So the quicker you do this, the quicker we both go home. Okay. And he just looked at me and went, yeah, okay. And smiled like, no messing. Straight talking. This is the deal. This is what you're doing. Now you do it. And now we're going to go. So, yeah.
Nice one. I love it. What would you say is the biggest misconception about your job?
I think most people have said this, but I'm going to say that it's glamorous. You know, like I said before, you know, you could be writing a script on a plane. It's long hours. I'm just going to stop there because there's a helicopter coming and it's, can you still hear that? Do you want me to stop for a minute?
If you can hear it, then let's stop. Yeah, it's not picking
it
up on me, but
quite
low
here, so.
Yeah.
I'll pick it up at Glamorous.
Glamorous.
Glamour of F1. Okay, the helicopter's gone. I think most people think the job is glamorous. And the reality is there's a lot of glamorous things about the sport, don't get me wrong. But the working side of the sport is quite different. You know, there are long hours you work. You have to work hard to get those opportunities as well. You know, they don't just fall at your feet. So you have to earn your reputation to be offered roles to, you know, in my interview when I started, before I started at FOM, I said I'd like to interview drivers one day. I somehow ended up doing that, but that's through hard work, being in the right place at the time, taking opportunity, trying things, getting to know people, learning new skills. So I'd say, you know, many people think, you know, or might think you're sat drinking coffee in the paddock all day when we wish. We very rarely manage to meet for a coffee in our later years in the sport because you're just so busy. But, you know, it's... There's lots of, I look back on my time, particularly at FOM, and when I was floor managing in the pit lane, you know, not every race is sunny. And yes. you can come back from a race and you've almost got trench foot. You know, and in the early days, I used to have to wear a fireproof suit as well. And I remember I'd be flying home on a Sunday night from Malaysia and my bag would be 30 kilos just because of the wet fireproof that was just...
In a fireproof suit. Yeah, that's a photo you need to share.
I do have a great photo. I like to call it my Top Gun years. I've got aviators on and yeah. I think Tomo took it for me and it's a great picture. But I think Canada 2011 was a particularly wet race. Went on for days. Yeah. And at the time we had a blue uniform. We only had it for 1 year. Thank goodness. Because I remember there were heli shots and you could just see F1 people on the pit wall. But you could just see these blue dots. it was the year that Rihanna came to the race. And obviously with the race being delayed, and I think she was a guest of McLaren. So I was sent, would she do an interview? And as is often the way, she wouldn't give me a firm no, but she was like, oh, maybe come back later. Would you just say no almost? Because then... come back later.
Yeah,
I don't know, about three times I got sent over the course of the delayed race. And in the end, she puts her hands on my shoulders. She goes, sweetie, do you mind if we... And she looked me up and down, because by this stage, I was a complete bedraggled, soggy mess. And hands on the shoulders and said to me, sweetie, do you mind if we don't? And I'm like, oh, goodness for that. I don't have to come back and ask again. This is getting embarrassing. But yeah, those are the less glamorous sides of things, you know. I've been lucky. I've interviewed lots of different celebrities and people have been very kind to take photos of me doing it so I can look back and go, yeah, Jay-Z, yeah. He's very much taller than I am. I'm just like this little thing standing there with my arm up in the air going, hi. But no, I look back at all these things and, you know, on the one hand, they're glamorous, but equally, I remember standing in Abu Dhabi with Jean-Michel for about 2.5 hours, having been told, yep, he's left the hotel. Where's the hotel? Dubai? Like, he's not here. 2.5, 3 hours later, we're still waiting, but I was going to get that interview, and we did, kind of thing. So, yeah, I'd say, you know, people think you're hanging out with the drivers all the time, and yes, you're working with the drivers, but, you know, you're there to do a job. You're maybe there to make them do the stuff they don't want to do, or, you know.
Yeah.
So it can appear like it's a very glamorous and very easy life, and it's not. You know, I think most people would realize that, but
I think they do now. I think there's so much more information about what each job is within motorsport that I think everybody understands that once you're backstage, it's a lot of hard work, and it's and it takes a lot of grit. I think grit and resilience is probably the two attributions that I would give to most people working backstage in motorsport. But it's good fun as well. We all keep showing up, so there's got to be a reason.
Resilience is definitely a word. Yeah.
Yes.
A trait that's needed.
Yeah, I think so. Especially when you're looking. Yeah. When you're looking at someone who's been in motorsport for a long time, I think the key factor I'm finding out more and more when I speak to so many, I'm so lucky to speak to so many people. Resilience is definitely a big one. And I also think stubbornness.
Yes, I have both those characteristics.
Yeah, which is, yeah, exactly. I'm not giving up. I'm going to keep showing up. I'm fascinated by whether or not you feel competitive, especially when you've had both hats. You've had the Formula One hat, which is access to everything, covering everything. And in which case, do you find yourself competing with other broadcasters, or are you in a much more global situation where you're observing the competition, but you're not part of it? And then team side, did you then suddenly feel competitive within your realm, within your work, to get one over the other teams or get something done better than anyone else? Or are you not competitive at all and you're much more focused on creativity? Was that ever part of your roles?
Is a competitive side to me. You know, I don't really like running the tracks with people because I don't really like to be beaten.
I don't like doing things unless I know I'm going to be the best. If I know I don't, I'm not.
It's funny. You still need that drive, even if you're not competing. You still need that drive to do the things that you do, to get yourself in the right place, to have the right, you know the right people, or to get things done. So you need a competitive edge because you need to be the best at what you do, I suppose I would say. And then, yes, when you move team sides, you know, you want to get the results. And, you know, we were lucky, obviously, now for Aston Martin, they're doing really well. And it looks like it's going to be a great season, which is fantastic to see for all the girls and boys in the garage there. But, you know, before that, Racing Point had been through some tough times. And 2020, we were lucky enough to have the win with Checo, as well as podiums and pole position for Lance. So, you know, there's nothing really that kind of beats those feelings of, you know, teamwork, what everyone's achieved. Like, I've never done a job that's made any car go faster, and nor will I ever do that. But you're still very much part of a team, and you're still part of that group of people. You know, teams, particularly now in the cost cap era, have to be very streamlined, and you're there because you need to be there. Your role, you know, you need to do your role. And, you know, looking back to COVID, when things were cut back, people traveling, etc., you know, my role grew actually because fewer people traveling, I needed to travel, so I took on other roles or got to work with different people and expanded that role. So whether it's competitive or just a determination, I've always wanted to be the best I can at my job. You know, I've never really put a label on anything I've done. I just want to be the best at doing it, and I want to be known for being good, which is something I feel I have managed to achieve. People, you know, believe in me and would see me as being successful in that sense, I suppose.
Yeah, I always thought of you as a safe pair of hand, which might it might, you know, not be the obvious good at your job, but it was that thing where I knew if you were on something I was involved in, it would be fine. It'll be great. Whereas some other projects, it might be a case of you maybe follow it a bit more closely, or you maybe safeguard it a little bit. You maybe check a bit more beforehand and afterwards. But if I knew you were on it, off we went. That was it. No problem. It was
I
easy.
I think as well, it's about, again, a lot of the job comes down to people and putting yourself in other people's positions. So, you know, everybody's important in a team. And, you know, I still speak to the cleaners from F1, from Biggin Hill, on social media. You know, that's, everybody's got a part to play in any team, business, what have you, because you can't lose any roles, if you like, you know.
You're in a space at the moment where you're able to look back on your career a lot more than you have been up till now. Is there anything that stands out as a proudest moment?
Proudest moment. That's a tricky one, because there's so many little things I'm proud of. So I would say, I don't know, can I say the whole thing? Because I've done it. Because
yeah, of course you can.
Yeah, I've done all of those different things. And, you know, in both my Formula One, you know, both at Racing Point Aston and Formula One, I think there was a clause at the bottom of the contract saying, and anything else the business requires you to do. And certainly in my FOM days, that could be anything. I've made the old F1 logo out of light bulbs, for example, which is challenging because the old F1 logo, as you recall, was chevrons, straight lines, and bulbs around. So there are some challenges there. We managed to overcome, and we even managed to use this structure the following year at the FIA Awards with the light behind it. So it had a kind of David Bowie, Heroes-esque kind of feel. So, you know, proud of those little wins. I've sewed a button on a jacket for Lewis when it came off at an awards ceremony. And despite all the people there doing clothing and hair and makeup, nobody had a sewing kit. But it was the first time Formula One had bought me a dress. And I was like, just in case, let's take the sewing kit from the hotel, just in case. And I'm not someone who wears a dress very often, and actually it was useful, you know. Always be prepared, I suppose.
Yep.
But yeah, absolutely. I think I'm proud of everything I've done in the sports. You know, there's been highs, more highs than lows. You know, I've met so many good people. I've met a few bad people, but by far the majority of people have been good people I've learned from. You know, I've been very lucky. So I think I'm proud of everything I've done, really.
Well, you touched on it for the slightest of time, so of course I'm going to go there now, which is, do you have a lowest point?
A lowest point? Well, again, my worst case scenario was always, if it all goes wrong, you just start again. So, you know, that period of gardening leave was tough. I just, you know, made myself look for jobs also, because I'd moved down to London as well, you know, from home. So I'd started to set up a life there and wanted to stay. So any lows I've encountered have just made me stronger, because I've fought to survive, or to not survive, too strong a word, but you know what I mean, to keep going. So
keep going.
You know, COVID was tough as well. Again, you didn't know what the outcome was going to be there. You know, being in a traveling sport, could the team survive? You know, could the sport survive? Nobody knew what was going to come. So again, I used the time to do some online courses to broaden my knowledge, and again, be prepared in case I needed to take on a fight in a new direction. So no, and I tend to not remember the lows. I, you know, there'll have been a bad day or whatever, and I tend to remember the good things more than the bad things. So
good way to be. Do you know, as you said, it still baffles me that we were in March 2020, we were in Australia, we were trying to kick off the season, which is obviously it's about to, you know, this time of year again, and we closed shop, had to come back, abort. And it only took until July, excuse me, it only took until July to get started again in a whole different way. And I don't think I appreciated it at the time, but as every year passes, I'm appreciating it more and more. How the hell did we do that? How the hell did people put their heads together and find a way for that sport to carry on, it's incredible.
It is. Absolutely incredible. You know, and having those people there ready to come up with solutions. I mean, I suppose you could think back, even then I'd forgotten about it, midnight test to release, driving to Silverstone, that's probably not a particularly high point. But you forget about those things, don't you? You do forget about those things. So I think, yeah, to see how the sport pulled together and pulled through that, and actually we had some good results was great, you know. So I feel very privileged.
What do you love the most about motorsport? Because I've got a feeling both are probably wrapped together.
Yeah, I think working as a team with people, and that team isn't necessarily the team of people like the race team necessarily. It could be the team of people I was working with at Formula One, and also when I was that floor manager, producer role, I often felt my teammates were actually you guys in teams, because I'd spend more time liaising and working with you guys than I did perhaps my close colleagues at Formula One. So it's always, you know, being around people, I think, you know, there's an excitement to the sport, of course. The sport's exciting. That appeals to me. But I definitely, having had some time to think, I enjoy being around people. I think that's what motivates me. You know, there's so many different people I've met over my time in the sport. And, you know, I think, like we said before, being humble and listening to people and working with all kinds of people from different backgrounds, doing different roles. Everybody's trying to get their job done, but you have to set it in the context of what's happening around you. But by being humble and listening to people, you know, you learn a lot, you know, and I've been really lucky, I think, of people who I've worked with, many of whom you've spoken to on this podcast, you know, Kate Bevan, Bernie Collins, but also people like Mike Crack, the team principal now at Aston. I only worked with him for a year, but he's such a good, it sounds bizarre to say he's a disruptor because he's so calm, engineering focused, but he just is a breath of fresh air to the sport. You know, he brought a new way of working and a new confidence to people, similar to when Liberty arrived in F1 and people like Sean Bratches were like, "You got an idea? Let's hear it. I don't care where the idea comes from. It doesn't have to come through your boss to come to me. If you've got the idea, tell me." And Mike's of that same kind of mindset of encouraging everybody to do well and to flourish and to thrive. And, you know, I've been lucky to have that experience. And I think that's what motivates me, to be with people who motivate me, who believe in me and give you that freedom to be the best you can be. So I'm not sure I'm quite answering your question there, but
here you are.
People.
Yeah, I can hear the answer. What about stress? I think sport in general, but Formula One especially, because of how fast moving it is, can be quite a stressful experience. And it's a lot of problem solving constantly. You know, we need to carry on. The race is happening at that time, no matter what. It's not going to wait for you. Let's carry on. Did you ever experience stress in your role, and how did you cope with it?
Yes. I think working in any live environment, be it television or in a racing team, it's a live environment. So there's stress because things are going to happen at a certain time, and that's your deadline. You know, you have to have things done by those deadlines. But also, I think I thrive off that to a degree. There was a time, so one of the things I used to do when I was floor managing was the podium interview. So I'd have to collect the podium interviewer. And I would say that's probably one of the most stressful things I've ever done in F1, because you didn't necessarily know who was going to be doing the interviews until very late on. And you'd have to brief them. And I remember one time it was Elton John, and we would generally want to have eyes on the person 5 laps to go. I don't think he arrived at the track until 5 laps to go, and in a tracksuit. Now, anyone in Paddock Club will tell you, I've had the jackets off Paddock Club security guards many times for podium interviewers who hadn't got a jacket, and I'd have to gauge who was the best size to put them in it, because Bernie always wanted them to be in a suit jacket. So and then that's like, there's Elton John in a tracksuit. Okay, well, off he went. And you know, you have to brief them in that short time. And there was another time we were going to the en route to the podium, and Bernie just came along with me, and I would be wearing the big cans on my ears, and obviously I could speak to the gallery, but also Bernie would hear me. So I was holding an umbrella over myself and Bernie, and I said, "Joanne to gallery, en route to podium with two guests." And literally my ears lit up, because everyone knew what I was saying was Bernie was with me without saying Bernie was with me. And they're like, "What's he going to do?" And it's like, how can anyone answer the question what Bernie's going to do? But, you know, so there's all kinds of stress. But at the same time, I'm not bringing world peace. I'm not finding medical cures and things. So you've got to put it in perspective. You know, they're minor stresses, and they're amusing anecdotes down the line, if you like. So there's never really anything that's so stressful that you can't overcome, you know, and just stop, take a breath, speak to someone with a calming mentality. Will Hings is great for that, you know, thinking under pressure. But you know, you are in those situations. I was in the pit lane when a cameraman was hit by Mark Webber's tyre. You know, all of those things can happen. Anything can happen. And you've just got to stop, think, and usually not say anything, because, you know, keep everything tight, keep everything under control, and take a step back before you start saying anything. You know, journalists would approach me in the hope that I'd say something, and I wasn't going to be doing that. So, you know that always stop and listen, stop and think.
How do you switch off? Well, how do you relax?
As you know, my hobby.
I can see the smile.
I have a slightly unconventional hobby away from the track. Something I started in 2019, I took up pole dancing. And I found it a way to stop thinking about work. There's something about hanging upside down on a pole that means you only think about that, because if you don't, you might injure yourself. But I decided last year, well, I actually did try and do this in 2020, but obviously COVID stopped everything. So I decided to take a pole dance class at every Grand Prix track that I could. So if people ever ask me, you know, what the things you usually take to a race, you know, my team kits, and my 8-inch pole shoes and knee pads kind of thing, which would often surprise people. But it's a great, you know, actually, I really wish I'd known about it as a fitness, a way of keeping fit in my younger days. I'd be a lot stronger and a lot fitter, and I would have wasted wouldn't have wasted as much time pounding the streets of Bromley and Croydon and probably had some more fun doing it. But it's been great. You know, so I took classes at as many places as I could last year, and then I would learn a choreographed routine. And then I've revisited it this year to show the journey I've been on and how much I've improved. So that's been a great thing for me to do, because you're meeting that community, you're meeting different people. It's a big community, actually, and people I've then kept in touch with, and now I'm starting to post the content. And as you know, I've been bothering you for advice.
Not bothering,
but it's great,
not
you know, having done what I've done for so many years, I've met so many people who are able to give me advice. So Jimmy as well, give me lots of tips and hints on doing things that I've been involved with. So as a producer, I've worked with many editors over the years, but I've never edited much myself. And so now I'm learning that skill, and my filming, I'm working on that. So it's been great, actually, as something, a way to kind of build on my own abilities and take them to another level, but also keeping fit, having fun. You know, it's a different hobby. I guess that seems to be a common theme. I seem to do things a little differently, I suppose.
marching to your own tune, but hey, if it's getting you dancing, then that's a great tune. What advice would you give to somebody who was interested in having a similar career to yours?
I think you've got to look for opportunities. You've got to be creative. You know, I, like yourself, I get a lot of people get in touch with me. How do I get the job? And there's no easy one answer, because we've all come different routes. When you think of all the different press people I've known over the years, not just the ones currently in the 10 teams, but over the years, people gone off into different things. You then end up speaking to someone who you knew 5 years ago. Everybody's had a different path and a different route. And I think just look for opportunities. Be nice. Be good at your job. Work hard. Be authentic. Be true to yourself. Don't try to be something you're not, because you'll be found out. You should be celebrating what you're good at and do what you are good at, not what you think you should do or what others think you should do, you know. This, to me, now, this makes me quite nervous, because you know me, I'm always behind the lens or to the side of the driver. Or
you're normally asking the questions.
But also when I was in interview, certainly doing Porsche, I didn't really use my voice either, so... you know, never seen, never heard kind of thing. So this is totally out of my comfort zone. You know, I knew I wasn't going to be a presenter or anything like that. That wasn't what I wanted to do. So I focused on what I want to do and being the best I can at that, not trying to be something I'm, you know, that I'm not going to be able to do. There's a slight difference between having the ambition to say, or the confidence to go, I'll give it a go. Thinking what's the worst can happen, to going for something that you are not going to be able to do and going to fail at. You know what I mean? There's a subtle difference there, I think.
Yeah. Yes. I will not be going for racing driver as a future project. I just won't be. I know that about me. That's
fine.
Can
I tell you a secret? Yeah. I've never been karting.
I've never been karting.
This is actually where we go back to the competitive side of me. I think I'd be so terrible, I won't do it in front of people. I'd have to learn. I'd have to go and take lessons first and get good.
That is so specifically what I would say. This is how I feel as well. There's not a chance in hell I'm going karting with anybody that works in motorsport. Everybody's got ex-driving or driving experience or think they can drive and they can't. I am not going karting in that environment.
And I
ever.
Have, you know... In theory, I'm small and reasonably light, so I should be good. And so I would look even worse if I actually did it.
Oh, I love it. That's brilliant. That's a good secret. Were you given some advice that you've used constantly that you'd be happy to share?
Only that my parents were always believers in working hard, and if you work hard you'll get where you want to be. It's as simple as that, really. You know, they were open to me having this crazy idea that I was going to work in Formula One, but they were like, well, you know, work hard and it'll pay off. So, and I think, yes, you can be lucky with timing, with opportunities, but if it doesn't happen now, it might happen in the future. That's the one bit of advice I would say. You know, there's been so many people around me, like I've said already, that I consider to be mentors. You know, Annie Bradshaw. I didn't work with Ellie Norman for very long, but the time I did, I learned a lot from her, from Sean Bratches. You know, there's so many people in sports, and you know me, I don't talk much on the subject of women in motorsport, because I still think there's a lot of work to do. You know, we're making great strides on the engineering side, on the technical side, and encouraging girls into STEM subjects. But the commercial side actually has a long way to go. And that's where we want to see women reaching the top, not just being there, but reaching the top. And people like Kate Bevan, you know, really pushing that forward. There are women at the top of the game. I'm thinking Chloe Target Adams. I'm thinking Emily Prazer, you know, with what they're doing with Chloe with race promotion, Emily now with Las Vegas, you know. So
yeah,
all of these people are actually mentors in their own way, if you like. So, you know, they've all come different paths. Kate Bevan, I know you've spoken with her. She came from a legal background. So there's all different ways into the sport and different parts of the sport that you can get into. You, there's no one path to say, do this. You know, you have a very different route into the sport to me and to other press people that we know. So yeah. I think you've just got to look at everything that's there and don't just focus on the one role. You know, I took a gamble on a job that had no obvious company and just thought, well, let's see what happens, you know?
Yes.
Sometimes it's worth a gamble.
Definitely. I always think, please work out what you want to do before coming into motorsport, because it's such a big breath, because there's so much that you could do. And the worst thing, the my heart sinks when someone comes up and says, I want to work in Formula One, what should I do? I'm like, please do the job first. Please do the bit where you know what you actually want to do. Because I've joked on this before, you could be a chef. You can be a chef and work in motorsport. You can be one of the catering teams and actually making incredible food for the guests or for the teams or for the drivers. There is nothing that's off limit almost. We have doctors. We have doctors and nurses that come with us to every single. So you could even be part of the, you know, the doctor profession and end up in motorsport. So, yeah, I always think that's the key. It's know who you are, know what you want to do, and then crack F1.
Completely, because you need to bring something as well. Because if you follow the same career path as someone else, chances are you're not going to break through. You know, you need to find your own path and know what you want to do.
I can't believe it, but this is my last question. What are you looking forward to?
Like I said, it's great to see Aston doing well. You know, those guys and girls in the garage have worked hard. They've had some tough times, and you know, it's great to see that that's coming good for them, and to see Lance and Fernando doing well. For me, I want to work for Wrexham Football Club. So, you know, Ryan Reynolds, Rob McElhenney, or Fleur Robinson, they have a female CEO listening, then I'm here. Or maybe Vegas, perhaps, I don't know. No, I just, for me, I think I'm looking forward to seeing a good season and having a bit of time out for myself to spend the time with friends and family. You know, it is a tough sport in terms of your life and what you give. You know, I haven't been able to spend the time with my husband, my family and my friends that they deserve. And now it's time to focus a little bit more on them and just enjoy life and what opportunities come my way. You know, I'm not sure what I want to do next, but I know it's going to be good.
I can't wait to see you do it, whatever shape it comes. I know it's not going to be boring.
That or a pole dancer, who knows.
The only thing left is for me to thank you for being an absolutely brilliant guest. Thank you so much, John, for coming on here and being so honest and telling such brilliant stories. I absolutely loved it.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm very honoured to have been asked, actually. So thank you very much for having me here.
Oh, that was the amazing Joanne. I love her story so much. And she's such a calming influence in the paddock. She's so good at managing situations and seeing the story behind the story. I hope that came through in our chat today. She's absolutely lovely. I know it was a tongue-in-cheek mention, but I would genuinely love to see her join Wrexham Football Club in the near future. She's such a gifted storyteller. It would be absolutely brilliant to see what she does there. I'd like to thank the producer of this show, Press Play Productions. The awesome Tabitha is the one who turns our brilliant chats into the very nicely edited podcast you listen to each time. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe via your favourite podcast platform, leave a review if you can, tell your friends, post about it on social media. The full works, it means so much and it really helps people find this little podcast. As you know, I read every message and every mention and it really means the world to me. You can also get in touch directly if you'd like via my Instagram account, which is Pandea, that's P-A-N-D-E-A. And there's also a link in the show notes via which you can support the podcast directly should you wish to. Thank you very much for listening and speak to you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.